Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome to the Steps to Investing podcast, your home for stock market news and ideas to help you beat high inflation by getting you investing for a better return. I'm Marcus De Silva. And a very warm welcome to episode 7 of series 5. I hope all of you are very well. We've got a brilliant interview today, as always. It's Laith Califf. We've had him on the pod a few times. He's from the investing platform AJ Bell, and he's super knowledgeable about the markets. And he's going to be discussing something really practical today. It's investing strategies that you might employ in an unusual recession, which the UK is facing at the back end of this year and into next. So hopefully give you lots of ideas there. Lots going on in markets, as always. Quite a bit of volatility. There's lots to report on in the UK this week. We are going to have an explainer as well with what's been going on with the pension funds. I'm sure you've probably been reading a little bit about that. They, in particular, have been affected by volatility in the gilt markets, the UK government bond markets. And we're going to hop through some company news. We've got IKEA for you, Starlink, Tesco, and EasyJet. Of course, please share with friends if you are enjoying the podcast. And many thanks to our sponsors, Janus Henderson Investors, for their support, helping us educate and inform private investors. Okay, let's start with the markets and what I've been chatting to the market analysts at Hargreaves Lansdown about. Well, you know, of course, overall, overarchingly, there's these issues of very high inflation and central banks battling that with rising interest rates, which is putting the brakes on economies. But, you know, delving underneath the surface, let's start with the UK. A couple of weeks ago, the end of September, we saw some revised economic growth figures from the ONS, the Office of National Statistics, and they had revised that the second quarter, rather than shrinking by 0.1%, it actually grew by 0.2%, which, you know, is sort of at the margin there, but when it means we're not in you know, near recession territory yet. It also said that the pandemic was actually worse than we thought in terms of its impact on the economy. It sliced 11% off rather than the 9.3% as it initially thought. So whilst this, as I say, it's all kind of around the margins, but what it means is that the economy is actually 0.8% smaller than was previously thought. So this adds some further pressure on Chancellor Kwarteng's view of tax receipts and the fact that he will have less money than he previously thought for the plans in his mini budget, which is not good news considering it was sort of seen, a lot of those tax cuts were seen as unfunded. Adding to the pain, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the IFS, came out and said the sums don't add up and there will be a significant shortfall in revenue. Of course, what they were suggesting was, well, then you're going to therefore need massive austerity cuts in order to deal with this. The Chancellor is likely to massively rebuff those. I don't think there's any desire to go back into austerity. Fitch, now, you may remember, this is a ratings agency, and you may remember ratings agencies from the global financial crisis and the fact that they weren't really doing the jobs properly in the way they rated a type of product called mortgage-backed securities. Well, they have just downgraded the UK credit rating. So they assess governments, they assess companies in the same way in which they would assess us for credit worthiness, and they've downgraded the UK from AA stable to AA negative, which means that the interest that investors will want when they're buying, when they're lending money to the government, is going to need to be a little bit higher because we're deemed to be more risky. So that's not great, and it has the knock-on effect to other part of the debt market. So I'm sure it's not going to be a help given that mortgages, you know, the rates of mortgages are at 14-year highs. Of course, there's been plenty more volatility in the gilt market. That's the UK government bond market. The Bank of England is due to end its bond buying programme on Friday the 14th. I think there have been plenty of pleas from the industry, from pension funds, that they extend that support. and they've said that they're not going to for the moment on the day of recording. This is Thursday the 13th, so, you know, who knows? It's due to end tomorrow. But, you know, I think there's probably a big internal battle going on there, really. It's independent. It's not there to bail out harebrained schemes from the government. But at the same time, it can't let the gilt market go into meltdown either. So it's sort of struck with this, you know, because it's dealing with basically financial stability. But on the other hand, it's also got to deal with monetary policy. And when you're trying to control inflation, you don't want to be opening the taps, you want to be closing them. So that's clearly the sort of, you know, the internal battle that they're facing, really. So yeah, see what happens there. As a result, the pound is trading pretty weakly, although I did see it improve a little bit, as there's some sort of rumours that the Prime Minister Liz Truss will reverse some of those tax cuts. But also, you know, pension funds, they're in a bit of a bind, really. I'm going to do an explainer on that just next. Moving on to our cousins across the pond, we saw data that highlighted unemployment is pretty low. Also, the latest consumer price index reading, that's a measure of inflation, CPI, that did come in hotter than analysts forecast. So it was 8.2% instead of a forecast of 8.1%. So markets there have sort of gone downwards this week, really, because they're fearing much harsher interest rate hikes, and they've had some pretty big 0.75% hikes already. We saw some minutes from one of their big meetings. It's called the Federal Open Market Committee meeting, the FOMC meeting, and it highlighted that indeed, you know, the members of that committee are quite worried about inflation, which is proving quite stubborn. But there were some hints that it may slow the pace of its rate rises. Over to the oil markets, and that's been a bit of a talk of the town over the past fortnight. We heard from OPEC, and they said that they, you know, they were expected to reduce production, given that the global economy is softening and slowing down. The consensus, you know, they sort of hovered around, but I think they thought about a million barrels a day would be the cut. Unfortunately, it came in at 2 million barrels a day. So that's certainly fanning the flames of inflation, and not to mention some pounding headaches, no doubt, for global leaders. And we heard from Biden, and he was pretty clear of his disapproval. He was homing in on the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. That said, towards the back end of the week, the price has actually dropped. So it went up off the back of that, and it hit a high of nearly $98. It's actually come back down a little bit this week to $91.5 when I was looking at this last for Brent crude. So you know, that's probably a bit of a relief. And as I said, it's around these worries about global growth, really. We heard from the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, who downgraded global growth forecasts this year from 3.3% to 2.7%. In China, its tech stocks are on the retreat a little bit. US, the Biden administration has come out with curbs on exports of certain chips, semiconductors. So that's certainly hit the tech sector. And, you know, we heard that there's been some fresh COVID outbreaks as well, with new restrictions. That's really, it's not being great for China at all. That we do have the party conference, the big party conference this weekend. So there are hopes that they may change course on their zero COVID policy. All in all, since Thursday, September 29th, the S&P 500 is down 3.75% to 3,502 points. The FTSE 100 is down 2.02% to 6,738 points. Europe's Stoxx 600 is down 0.71% to 380 points. And the Nikkei 225 is down 0.7% to 26,237. Okay, so I thought for the explainer, I would explain, well, you'd hope so, wouldn't you, what is going on in the pension funds and the gilt markets, really, because there is a bit of complexity to it. So it's really to do with a part of the pension market called the defined benefit pension market. So DB schemes, right? Often called final salary pensions. And what these are is, when you retire, you're going to be paid a portion of your final salary each year until you die. Now, these are very generous. Many have been closed, particularly in the private industry. They do exist in the public industry, because basically we're just living too long. So, you know, the liabilities of them is, rather than funding you for 10 or 15 years, it's 25 or 30 years. So they're very expensive to run, and hence why we don't sort of really see them. And most workplace pensions will be what we call DC schemes, defined contribution schemes. Nonetheless, there's a fair bit of assets in these DB schemes, amounting to just over £2 trillion in assets. And what it means is, you know, in any given year, these funds will have a big liability. They'll need to pay some lovely pensioners their income. So they invest in income-generating assets that are quite reliable, of course, because they've got to manage those risks, those liabilities. So they buy lots of gilts, government bonds, because, of course, you know, when you're looking at the spectrum of assets out there, government bonds, especially in the developed world, are meant to be among the safer of those assets that you can potentially buy. Now, if the market suddenly move the wrong direction, or inflation suddenly leaps, then that can be a problem for the liabilities, you know, the cash that they need to pay the pensioners. So they hedge some of these gilt positions, and they use a type of derivative called an LDI, liability driven investing. And it, you know, it's a bit complex. We don't really need to know that much about it, but what these kind of derivatives require is you've got to put some money down, right? It's a leveraged position. You'll put a small amount of collateral and get a sort of a bigger exposure off the back of it. The thing is, when the gilt market spikes, then suddenly the providers of those LDIs will say, well, we're going to need some more collateral, please. But after Chancellor Kwarteng's mini budget, it spiked very sharply. And I think I mentioned in one of my previous pods that it was like the biggest spike we've seen in 30 years. 9/11 didn't cause the same magnitude of movement as this mini budget. So it suddenly meant that these calls came in, these collateral calls came in very, very quickly, and these pension funds were suddenly like, oh, I haven't got the cash. I need more cash. So what do? You go to the things that are easy to trade, your very liquid positions, and that generally is gilts, because it's an enormous market. Vast quantities of gilts are traded every day. So it means that it should be easy to raise cash. But of course, you're selling into a market that's falling, which exacerbates the falls further, and it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. So it's why the Bank of England needed to come in and say, all right, fine, we're here, we'll buy those for you. So that's how they were trying to create this backstop to the industry, to the falls in the market. So that is what's been going on. That's where there's been quite a lot of volatility, and why these pension funds have been sweating and trying to persuade the Bank of England to carry on being that backstop. And they're moving into other assets, really, trying to sell those, like property and shares. But these are taking longer to sell. And, you know, some of them are having to be sold at hefty discounts. So it's creating losses for the funds. So you can begin to see how, you know, you almost get this technical bit in a market, and if there's enough volume in that, then it can sort of spread and spiral out, really, which is, I'm sure, what no one really wants. So, you know, it's important that it's dealt with. $2 trillion is clearly a weighty market. So interesting one there. I think future bound, once this storm has passed, expect to see the regulators take a look at how these positions were managed by the pension funds. Okay, company news. Let's have a little quick hop through some of the headlines that I found interesting. Starlink. So this is the space-based internet service that was created by Elon Musk's SpaceX. It's back online following some outages, which is very good news for the Ukrainian army. Musk had been praised way back when the war started for providing these services pretty quickly, and it's proved very important to the Ukrainian army, but they'd had some outages along some of the front line, which had been, I think, quite frustrating for the Ukrainians. And it's interesting, really, because you know, great thing that he did there. They were very pleased about that. But he's also, incensed some of the Ukrainians as well, really, after sort of suggesting in some Twitter-based poll that they cede territory to Russia in order to de-escalate the war. So, bit of a weird one there. And I think it raises questions about billionaire business people really sticking their oar into geopolitics. Popular furniture global megastar IKEA has said it can finally start to reduce prices on some of its key products as the supply chain logjams it had faced are now easing a little. It had had to raise its prices on average by about 9% because of the problems it had due to COVID. So getting those raw materials and also shipping costs suddenly going up very sharply. EasyJet came out and said it was likely to report a smaller than expected loss of between 170 and 190 million in its year up to the end of September, which is a big improvement on the £1.1 billion loss in 2021, which was on account of harsh COVID restrictions. Chief Executive Johan Lundgren said that he felt its low-cost offering would be quite appealing in an economic downturn, even in the midst of a searing cost of living crisis. And finally, Tesco, they reported a 3.5% rise in half-year sales to 28.2 billion, but also an operating profit fall of 9.8% to 1.3 billion. And of course, cost of living is playing a big part in this. Tesco has really managed to deal with this very well, kept its prices low, adjust things around, but I think it is starting to feed through into performance. Okay, let's get on with our interview with Leif. So in this week's interview, I wanted to delve into a quite practical topic for listeners, and that's thinking about how we might go about investing, what kind of strategies we might pick, given that we've got this pretty dreary economic backdrop that's been driven by the searing cost of living crisis, these rising interest rates. The Bank of England are forecasting a recession that's probably going to start this year and last for most of next year. So, you know, what do you do in that environment? How do you go about investing? So to chat through this today, I'd like to welcome back onto the pod AJ Bell's Head of Investment Analysis, Leif Callett. Leif, welcome.
Thanks for having me again, Marcus.
Leif, do you want to start by giving us a good idea of what this economic climate is? It seems pretty bleak, I'm sure you'll agree.
Yes, it's. I think that's fair to say. So as you say, we've got the cost of living crisis, which is biting not just here, but across most of the world. We're really kind of coming off the back of the pandemic, of course, and we had economic growth as we all emerged from that. That was slowing anyway, but I guess the real sort of break on economic performance has been the invasion of Ukraine and the effect that has had on inflation and also on interest rates. Both of those things really taking their toll on the economy and especially the UK economy. Double digit inflation, that money that's being spent on higher fuel prices, on higher energy prices to heat your home, on higher prices across the board, really, because that all feeds through into business prices and the prices we see on the shelves as well. All of that really kind of constrains, our consumption, the spending that we might have put onto other items. And at the same time, we're also seeing higher interest rates come through. Again, that means higher mortgage rates, and that's, again, a constraint on consumer spending. But it also means that, companies are facing higher borrowing costs as well. And that obviously reduces the amount of money they have to pay people to invest in the economy because they're paying more in terms of the interest on their borrowing. So, all of that has added up into a pretty bleak economic picture. I think more recently we have obviously had the mini budget which didn't start a lot of these trends, but actually seemed to act as a sort of pretty rapid accelerator, particularly when it comes to interest rates, with kind of bond yield spiking, and that obviously feeding through into the mortgage market as well. So yeah, all in all, pretty bleak picture, I'm afraid.
And I mean, the other factor that we've seen particularly recently is that the pound has been weakening quite some time. I mean, it almost got to parity with the dollar. What impact does this have on the economy?
Well, there are a number of impacts. I mean, probably first to point out is the fact that it's not just sterling weakness. That's definitely part of what's going on there, but there's a lot of dollar strength going on as well. Our currency has been weak, but it's particularly weak against the dollar. It's been much stronger against the euro, although still weakening this year. There's a kind of tale of two different currencies there, sterling and dollar as well. So, the kind of fall in sterling, and particularly the fall in sterling we've probably seen in the last couple of weeks, is really kind of a sign of a lack of confidence, particularly, I guess, in the UK economy. People liquidating UK assets because they don't necessarily want to be invested here anymore. The effect that it has on the economy in the short term is that a weaker pound makes inflation a thornier problem, and that is because the cost of imports goes up. So things like energy, oil, and gas are priced in dollars, as are a lot of other commodities. And if your currency is weakening, that means that kind of to convert it into dollars, well, you're not getting quite as much bang for your buck, literally, as you were before. And so everything becomes more expensive. So that's the kind of very short-term sort of prognosis. I mean, there is kind of a positive from a weaker exchange rate, which is perhaps a bit longer term, which is that it actually makes yourself more competitive as an exporting nation. So it's kind of cheaper for foreigners to buy our goods, and so we are kind of in theory a bit more competitive now than we used to be. But that's kind of much more of a slow burn, and I think that's also perhaps kind of more questionable a benefit nowadays when, I think things like, the kind of UK's manufacturing base is obviously a lot smaller than it was. And, things don't adjust as rapidly as that, in terms of kind of, I guess, all the kind of feed through in terms of, kind of supply chains that are necessary to actually, boost investment in the country. But in theory, potentially longer term, it could mean that we are more competitive on a global stage for kind of people buying UK products. That's the positive spin on it.
Now, as I said at the top, the Bank of England is forecasting a recession likely to start at the end of this year and expected to last throughout most of 2023. Now, you, when I spoke to you about this, you described it as an unusual recession. Why would you describe it as such?
Well, I think the unusual, I guess, aspect to it is what's happening with monetary policy, because normally, if the economy is starting to fall backwards, what you would normally be expecting is for central banks to be helping. By lowering interest rates and helping the economy to grow again, but this is as I said, an unusual sort of economic slowdown, because what we've got is that it is in part being precipitated by central banks pushing interest rates up, and they are continuing to push interest rates up, and the reason for that, of course, is that their mandate is to control inflation, and inflation is manifestly out of control. we've kind of got, you know, a situation where the economic picture is deteriorating and the cavalry isn't coming to back us up, which is normally what happens and what's really kind of been the picture for the last 25 years, really, since central bank independence, is that central banks would stimulate the economy in this situation. But they've got a bigger problem, which is inflation, and they're remaining focused on that because at the end of the day, that is really what their credibility rests. And so we can't really expect any help in the immediate term from central banks taking their kind of foot off the brake in terms of interest rate hikes, I'm afraid.
Mm. So it's almost like friendly fire, actually. It's they're kind of adding to the pain by having to hike interest rates, because ultimately longer term embedded inflation could be a lot more damaging on the economy. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, if they don't take action, then actually kind of inflation gets out of control and it becomes deeper and more entrenched than it already is. And to be honest with you, we don't really know how big the problem is. You know, kind of all the forecasts that we've got suggest that inflation is going to tail off, and if global demand, you know, if we are going through a recessionary period, if a global demand slows or even goes backwards, then you would expect that would be the case. But equally, you know, projections so far have proved to be a little bit anemic in terms of what we can expect from inflation. So, you know, I think it would be dangerous for central banks not to take it seriously, which, you know, that clearly they are doing.
Okay, well, let's get on to some of the strategies that you suggest that might be quite good for investing in this unusual recession, as you very clearly painted out there. And we're going to start with investing styles. Now, you suggest that it's probably quite a good idea to have a bit of a blend of styles in your portfolios rather than going for a particular one. Do you want to explain a little bit about investing styles first, and then why you think this blend is probably quite a good idea at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are various different kinds of styles. You can kind of chop up the kind of investment market into various different sort of sectors or pieces. I think probably the kind of, when we're talking about styles, we're often talking about fund manager styles, different ways of investing. And probably the two biggest sort of camps that you get are growth and value. So growth being, you know, fund managers who look for companies that are delivering growth in their profits and aren't too worried about what price they pay. As long as those profits are growing, that's what they're expecting to drive their portfolio performance. And on the other hand, you've got value investors who are looking for cheap stocks, things that are really kind of beaten up by the market. They might not be growing a great deal, but their price is such that they are hugely undervalued in terms of their, you know, what the kind of intrinsic business is. So these are kind of two very different approaches to investment management, and so two very different investing styles. And, you know, I think in a typical recession, you might try and avoid the kind of the value funds because they often include quite a lot of cyclical companies, so things like oil and gas and banks, things that you wouldn't expect to do well when the economy is taking a back seat. And I think that just might be slightly different this time around, because the fact that we've got rising interest rates means that banks actually are one of the kind of sectors that actually benefits from rising interest rates. And as we know, things like oil and gas are part of the kind of inflationary problem. And actually, if you look at kind of oil and gas majors this year, they've actually performed very well. So I just think that it's worth kind of keeping a foot in both camps, because we don't really know how the kind of recession or economic slowdown is going to play out, and really kind of, you know, there are risks to growthier areas of the market as well, and we've seen that taking place this year as well, whereby higher interest rates you know, have really damaged the kind of attractiveness of kind of longer term cash flow. So, you know, something that's you know, kind of 5 years away, if you've got a company that's growing fast and it's going to deliver you a nice cash flow in 5 years' time, you know, if interest rates are zero, then, you know, actually that's not too much of a problem, because you're not missing out on too much in the meantime waiting that 5 years. If suddenly interest rates are 5%, you can get 5% interest a year, interest rate a year, well, hang on a minute, you are missing out on quite a lot over 5 years. And so that kind of, you know, has I think taken the edge off kind of growth stock. So I just think it's worth keeping a balance in your portfolio, because we don't know how it's all going to play out. And it's perfectly possible that, you know, in the short term, none of this stuff does well, actually. You know, that actually the economic picture is such that very few companies are really able to produce, you know, kind of a positive return in the short term. I'd be surprised if that was the case in the longer term, but that may well be the case in the short term. But just because we're entering, again, a very uncertain period, just maintaining some balance across kind of, you know, cyclical and defensive stocks, value and growth stocks, I think is probably a wise idea within an equity portfolio.
I'm just wondering, one of the bits of rationale that you hear around stock picking at the moment is fund managers saying, look, I'm trying to find companies that have some pricing power in this inflationary environment, because if costs are going up, then what pricing power means is that ability to pass on those costs to your consumers in the form of raising your prices. I'm just wondering if there are any portfolios that focus on those types of companies.
There may be some funds. I mean, I'm not sure that I'm not aware of any that are specifically about pricing power, although there are kind of a plethora of kind of ETFs out there that you know, kind of pander to any particular fancy you might have in the market, really. So it's possible that there are one or two of those. It does feed through into the investment strategy of a lot of fund managers, probably fund managers who sit in the growth camp, and probably in the quality growth camp, quality being kind of robustness of a company's finances. And they tend to like pricing power because it acts as a bit of a buffer against, you know, kind of some of the economic conditions that we're seeing at the moment. I think one of the things that I would point out, and again, this comes back to diversifying, is actually, you know, those companies with pricing power have found themselves trading on kind of very high prices over the last kind of five to 10 years. You know, actually their valuations are high, and that means potentially they do have further to fall if suddenly their growth trajectory is not quite as stellar as it might previously have seemed. So there is kind of a valuation risk there in those companies. But you know, the principle in terms of the business is a good one, that pricing power provides you with a buffer against adverse market conditions. So, you know, if you've got a profit margin of, say, 20%, and you're dealing with inflationary costs coming at you, which mean that you're paying your workers more, you're paying more for inputs, you're paying more for commodities, you know, maybe your costs are rising by 20%, then, you know, that margin protects you, some of your profits. And also pricing power means that you can pass some of that on to your customers. Whereas, you know, if your company, which is trading on a, you know, a 1% profit margin and doesn't have any pricing power, no ability to pass those costs on to consumers, then pretty soon you can find yourself making a loss. So that's the theory, and it's, you know, and it's sound. But I'd also just sound the caution that a lot of those kind of companies also tried it trading on high valuations, not as high as they were at the beginning of the year, but that also presents a risk as well.
Yeah, and I think serves your point nicely about needing balance, really, because the thesis may be sound, but it won't necessarily play out that way. It depends on some other factors there, and those you know, those growth areas of the market have been punished in this current environment. Okay, let's move on to your next idea, and that's seeking out strategies within equity income. So that's fund managers who are looking for companies that are paying a strong level of dividends.
Yeah, sure. So again, I just think that I think in a world where you don't have a huge amount necessarily of economic growth going through, that makes it more difficult for companies to actually kind of grow themselves, grow their earnings. Actually, those that have a well kind of sustainable and reasonable dividend actually offer investors, kind of one in the hand rather than two in the bush. If you're getting a dividend yield of kind of 4 or 5% from a company, and that is and it's not a dividend that's stretched at the moment and isn't likely to come under pressure, then actually that might offer a good return. A good portion of the return for investors, when you've got a market which might be, kind of finding it difficult to make any headway. And I just think that, those kind of stocks might come a bit, into favor a bit more. A lot of them again sitting in the a lot of them sitting in the kind of value bucket often, rather than the growth bucket. I think that there might be some. I guess the kind of recent sell-off that we've seen in the bond market might actually start to figure in this as well, and perhaps not in a good way, in that you can now get your 10-year bond, and actually your kind of 2-year government bond is now yielding 4%. So that's actually now a much more reasonable rate of return than it's offered for a considerable time. And that might actually shift people out of dividend paying stocks. It might shift people out of equities altogether and all sorts of different asset classes. I don't think it's going to happen for the moment because there's still so much uncertainty about the bond market, that I think people are kind of rightfully fearful to tread there. But that might be kind of an emerging risk. But kind of putting that to one side, the idea of kind of something that is going to pay you a 4 or 5% return in an uncertain market is now I think quite appealing. And the price might go up and down, and you might have to wait, kind of 3, 5, maybe even 10 years before the kind of price actually gives you a good return. But at least in the meantime, you're being paid to wait.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make because for a long time, really, ever since the global financial crisis, when we had very low rates of interest, people were getting nothing really on bonds that they switched into seeking dividends in those kind of funds. Could it be the beginning of a big long-term trend out of equity income funds?
I think it might be a move out of, I guess, more kind of the kind of, I guess, the growthier areas of the market that offer a dividend. Because the reason I say that is because there hasn't people have been selling out of UK equity for the last equity income for the last five or more years, actually. It's been really unpopular. Because it is those kind of traditional companies which have just fallen out of favor. So until this year, the banks, the oil and gas companies, tobacco, defense, all these things which have actually had a good year this year, people weren't really interested in them. And although we've seen the price appreciate this year, there's still not big flows going into UK equity income. I think that there are perhaps some stocks which people who were previously kind of bond investors might have turned to. So, kind of the kind of safer, in inverted commas, area of the equity market, which were often known as kind of bond proxies, because they offered you a bit of income, reliable earning streams, and that kind of appealed to bond investors, because that's kind of why they bought bonds until the income just dried up. And so we did, I think, see kind of a very big movement into those kind of stocks, when interest rates fell to historic lows. And I suspect that those stocks might actually kind of come under pressure if people start moving back towards bonds. Like I said, I don't think we're there yet. Bond yields are rising, which in itself is a sign that people are still selling bonds. And obviously, central banks are still hiking interest rates, which again is not good for bonds. But there might come a point, and that inflection point could be without wishing to delve too deeply into the crystal ball here, that inflection point could be when we start to see central banks moderating their tightening of monetary policy. Because at that point, markets might go, oh, hang on a minute. There's, you know, we've kind of been looking at rates going up and up and up, and now they're starting to take their foot off the brake, and that might prove a bit of an inflection point for bond markets, which might see people actually reconsidering their position and thinking, well, you know, we can now get a reasonable rate of return on bonds. They don't have as much valuation risk, and actually central banks are no longer kind of hiking rates quite as aggressively, and at that point you might get a bigger move into bonds, which might unsettle other parts of the market too.
I want to get on to then the wider kind of diversification that investors can do, and that's through multi-asset funds. What are these, and why is this a good idea, do you reckon?
Yeah, well, I mean, actually interesting in terms of kind of the bonds that we've just been talking about, because multi-asset funds will invest in bonds. So these are kind of one-stop shop funds, which are... you know, they invest across equities, typically global equities, but also bond markets, cash, and quite often property and gold as well. And so that the idea of them is that they're investing in kind of a wide range of assets, you know, kind of these assets move in different directions to each other at different times. So what you actually get is you probably don't get the kind of, you know, amazing long-term returns of a full equity portfolio, but you get a lot less of the ups and downs, because when kind of equities are moving down, you tend to get the other assets in the fund acting as a bit of ballast and kind of holding up your portfolio. And, you know, those assets probably won't do quite as well when risk is on and the equity markets are doing really well. So you get a bit more of a kind of nuanced approach. You get a bit more of a, I guess, slow and steady approach to investment management. A lot fewer ups and downs, hopefully still making a reasonable real return, but without the kind of harum scarum of a full equity approach. And actually, they might be kind of you know, kind of worth considering, I guess, for kind of particularly for kind of more conservative investors, and for those investors, I guess, who don't want to manage their own portfolio, they kind of want someone else to do it for them.
So perhaps a bit of a good core holding to have one of these multi-asset portfolios in your own portfolio.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, that's right. So they give you a very core base of diversification. And then if you do want to do stuff around the edges of it, you can, and you know that you've got that kind of, you know, that kind of, you know, kind of basic core covered by someone who's running a, you know, a very well-balanced portfolio.
So this is what we have discussed this a bit on the pod before, but this kind of strategy of core and satellite as well. So you have like a nice core that kind of hoists you to your goals, and it represents the majority. And then you have these little satellites of these maybe slightly more exciting things that you invest in, that I suppose drives a bit of interest, but also can add some alpha if they go right. Okay, and then finally, I just wanted to touch on smaller companies, really. Now, this one surprised me a little bit. I mean, smaller companies tend to be quite domestically exposed, very sensitive to economic swings. You talked about cyclical there. So why do you think this is a good idea?
Well, yeah, you're right. This is a controversial one. the reason I thought it's worth looking at. There are a couple of reasons, actually. One is that if you look at the performance of the market so far this year, the FTSE 100, the big boys and girls of the market, have held up reasonably well, largely a result of the fact that we've got kind of quite a high exposure to commodities and oil and gas within the FTSE 100. But the kind of mid and smaller cap side of the market have sold off quite considerably. So kind of, you know, around 20% or more so far this year. So I just think that there's already been a fairly big correction. And you're right, that might not be the end of the correction, because these things are hugely volatile. And definitely in the short term, there is scope for more pain. But I also just think this is probably one, particularly for investors who are taking a long-term view, and by which I'm talking kind of, you know, 10 years or so. And, you know, it's just a kind of in the longer term, these kind of companies do tend to do better than the kind of the bigger kind of large caps, because they do have a greater capacity for growth, and they are often, you know, masters of their own destiny to a greater extent, in that, you know, the drivers of their growth might be kind of much more localized to them rather than the kind of big companies, which are really kind of, you know, kind of hostages of fortune to what's going on in the economy. You know, something like Shell, for instance, is a company that is, you know, very heavily driven by what's going on in the oil price. Shell has absolutely no control over that. Whereas I think kind of with smaller companies, they might be kind of growing in their markets, then there might be kind of secular reasons why they're able to continue that growth. And in the meantime, you know, tough economic times are going to mean that the price of those stocks may well fall further. But I just think that they've got a fair amount of bounce back ability when things turn for the better. Although I would also, this is, it's kind of an area in the market where I would say it's important to probably go with a kind of active fund manager, because the smaller companies market is quite large. There are a lot of companies which are not particularly good companies within that. They're perhaps not particularly robust companies, and particularly in an area of rising interest rates might find themselves in trouble. And it's historically been an area where actually fund managers, active fund managers, have been able to kind of apply their trade quite well, because it's less well analysed and it's easier for them to research hidden gems and sort of unearth those hidden gems, which, you know, the market might not recognise for a while. But, you know, ultimately, if earnings come through, that will kind of drive the share price. So a controversial one, definitely not for the faint hearted, but maybe one to just put on the radar for long-term investors who are feeling a bit adventurous.
Yes, it's this sort of idea that you know, a company is able to turn £1 into £2 much more easily than, you know, £2 billion into £4 billion, say. So that's why you can get these quite high rates of growth. It's why, you know, comparatively, as you mentioned, to larger companies, their performance can be quite good, but it's sort of hang on for dear life, really, because you know, it's a pretty volatile ride. But of course, you know, having been battered, the valuation point at which you enter is quite important in terms of your long-term return. So that's why it's a sort of, it's a contrary play, but it does mean that you're getting in at a time when, you know, values of the stocks look pretty cheap, I suppose.
It does, yeah. And, you know, like I said, I think, you know, things could well get significantly cheaper from here. And actually, just to kind of, you know, kind of probably wind up on the point, because it's, I think it's quite a good one, is that actually for this strategy particularly, but also all the other strategies that we've talked about, actually doing a regular investment is probably quite a good idea. Because rather than going in at one particular valuation point, i.e. now, when, you know, things are cheaper than they were, but they've still got scope to fall, by kind of investing regularly, you know, on a monthly basis, A, it's really easy, you don't have to think about it all the time, and B, it means that you're kind of buying in gradually. So you're never getting, you know, the best price or the worst price, but that does mean that kind of if things do fall, you're still buying in at kind of cheaper and cheaper in prices. So for me, that's actually probably, you know, the best way to invest, you know, probably at any time, but particularly when you've got really uncertain economic and market conditions.
Okay. I mean, they all seem good. So I just thought I'd finish with, just in terms of if you were wanting to pick out just some funds at the moment from, you know, the various sectors, there are many sectors that are out there. If you had a top sector that you would give your approval off, say go and have a look there, and maybe one that you wouldn't, that you would avoid at the moment.
I don't think I would do that, and the reason for that, Marcus, is, I guess coming back to the point, is that actually it's not time to kind of to try and be a hero, I don't think, and pick out the one thing that's going to do better than everything else. It's time to keep your irons in lots of different fires, I think. which is kind of coming back to that point of kind of diversification that we talked about at the beginning. So, you know, kind of rather than kind of, you know, trying to shoot the lights out with kind of one particular bet on the direction of a particular market, I think that's just too risky at the moment. So I think it's kind of one where you just need to kind of spread your bets around, and just maintain that balance, rather than putting kind of too much of your portfolio in just one particular area.
Okay, interesting. So big key message really at the moment is there's probably some good value out there, but diversification is the key. And to get round some of this market volatility, pound cost averaging, drip feeding your money in is probably also a pretty good strategy too.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up much quicker than I did. So yeah, thanks for that.
Laith Khalid, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Okay, well, a very big thank you to Laith for that interview. I thought it was really interesting. Good idea for some strategies there, given this looming recession, or potential recession, I should say. I think the other thing as well is, you know, a bit of confidence as well, that investing at times like this, when markets are a bit depressed, and I think in funds we're talking about here, it's risky business doing it in individual shares. But, you know, in well-managed active funds, so those are the fund manager, I think it can be a good time. You know, it's a good starting point, a low base from which to then over the long term hopefully deliver some pretty good returns for you. So, you know, try to move the anxieties aside and think about it in that very long term kind of way, you know, 10 years or more, and it can be quite lucrative to invest during these times. Next time around, we're going to speak to Ryan Hughes from AJ Bell. He's a really interesting chap, and we're going to be discussing a fund manager who soared all the way to the stratosphere before crashing back down to earth. It is the story of Neil Woodford. Until next time, goodbye.